We're in James chapter 5 and ready to start our study of verse 6 tonight. When we read the statement in verse 6, though, without the context and recognizing or understanding who to whom he's speaking here, then I have to say that right because the t-shirt my wife's wearing this evening. Got to have my grammar right. But anyway, we need to know the subject the ones that he's speaking to here to understand it properly, of course. And so in verse 1, he says, "Go to now, you rich men." And then everything that he's been speaking from that point down to and including verse 6 is to that group. And so here are the ones that are materially wealthy being warned of certain things. They're being described and warned. And we've already seen in our study of verses 1 through 5, they were instructed to weep and howl for the miseries that were going to come upon them. It was pointed out concerning the temporal nature of all of their possessions, which is true of anything that is of this world. It's all temporal. I mean, this world itself. I mean, there's nothing here that's eternal. And so their riches are corrupted and their garments are moth-eaten, he says in verse 2. And their gold and silver is cankered, and the rest of them would be a witness against them. Well, as those things they possessed were decaying, that very decay would be a testimony against what they were doing and loving and those things that aren't going to last. And he said they would eat their flesh as it were fire. And then he pointed out how they were heaping up treasure together for the last days. And last time we spent a good bit of time on that and looking at the problems with that. And forsake opportunities God gives us to use whatever we have now because we're going to try to store it all up for ourselves for a later date. What happens when that later date doesn't come? We looked at the rich man that was an example of that in Luke chapter 12, who planned to tear down his barns to build bigger ones to restore all of his goods that he had laid up for many years, and then his soul was required that night. I mean, he never lived to see it. So there are a lot of warnings there for anyone, any of us. And as we also noted, and we see in, we've seen in the book of 1 Timothy and chapter 6 and verses 8 through 10 particularly, that those that will be rich fall into temptation and a snare and drown themselves in many hurtful lusts. You don't have to actually have a pile of goods to be able to fall into the temptation to love those material things and to seek after those things. So even just having that desire is going to lead to problems that he's warning us against there. So that's why we need to have where our treasure is, where our heart will be also. And so we need to be setting our affection on the things that are above and seek those eternal things. He pointed out the kinds of practices that those that are covetous and will tend to engage in, starting with that first temptation of falling to that temptation to covet leads to many other temptations that go along with it. People that are money-minded, are they going to have scruples about how they obtain what they are desiring? Or does it go along with covetousness that find dishonesty and cheating and stealing and other practices like that will typically follow, and they do. And he said in verse 4 how they had they held back the hire of the laborers that reaped their fields. So they would they were cheating their workers out of their wages. They did the work, but then they don't pay the wages that they owed them. Well, then they've got, that's more for them. And, of course, that's wrong to do that. And so they were mistreating those laborers, and the Lord said that their cries entered into the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth, as we pointed out, that's the Lord of hosts, as he brings over that Hebrew word that we see so often in the Old Testament when he's describing the Lord of hosts. He's the Lord of everybody, and he was the Lord of those reapers who were being cheated by those rich ones that had hired them and didn't pay up. And then he said in verse 5 how they lived in pleasure on the earth and been wanton and nourished their hearts as in a day of slaughter. Well, nourished their hearts in a love for these pleasures and things of the world. So he's giving a very accurate description of the lives of people that have much of this world's possessions, and also what many people would aspire to as far as the kind of lives that they would like to lead. But God is warning us against that. All those things that are of this world are going to pass away, and if that's what we love, if that's what we've sought after instead of seeking God and the eternal things and preparing for that life to come, then we're going to be weeping and howling for those miseries of the loss of all of those things and then having to face the Lord in the judgment. Well, then we get to verse 6 where he says, "You've condemned and killed the just, and he doth not resist you." How far would they take their whatever their practices to get gain and to hoard those things? Can covetousness become so great that it becomes a motivation for murder? Well, what does 1 Timothy 6 and verse 10 identify as the root of all evil? The love of money. Has anybody ever been killed over money? I mean, it would be easier to identify the ones who are killed for some other reason. What's behind all the, in so many cities in our country today, I mean, murder rates are very high. What's going on there? What's all the killing about? All the drive-by shootings in Columbia, we've got a lot more of that going on here in our city. And there's a lot of violence. I mean, what's behind all of that? Yeah, it is. It's there's a lot of gang activity, but it's centered in turf wars for the things that people are doing, where they get their gain and the activities they're doing, and so they'll kill for that. They don't have to be. You don't have to be super wealthy to have that motivation to get things where people will even be willing to kill for it. People rob and steal and kill over very, very, very small amounts of money. But those that have a lot, how far are they willing to go to get more? And are they willing to kill for it? Well, the answer is yes, and he's speaking about that in verse 6, how far that can go, starting with that covetousness and what that can lead to, and all the other temptations that are there, and it can be carried to that extent. So he mentions there in verse 6 how they condemned and killed the just. That word condemned there is... It literally means to adjudge against. And, well, obviously, when they're going to make a judgment against them that they're willing to, I mean, that they're worthy to die, and then they kill them. Any examples from the Bible that come to mind of that? Cain and Abel. Well, there was some envy there over the sacrifices they were to offer. What's that? Jacob and Esau. Well, there was there was a desire to kill. There's a lot of envy there. Esau was very envious of Jacob for he'd gotten the birthright and gotten the blessing, so he was going to get more. And he was ready to kill for that. Jezebel, there we are. That's the one I was thinking of. And Naboth and his vineyard. You remember that? Here's Naboth. Did he do anything wrong? He owned a parcel of land. He had the... I mean, there's no way when all the lands for the tribes got divided up, no one could have foreseen that down the line, whatever Naboth inherited as his portion from the Lord for his family, that would end up being right next to the palace of the king, Ahab in that case, and that Naboth... You know, they say with real estate, it's location, location, location. But that was a bad location for that time, isn't it? If you had something valuable that was right next to where Ahab lived. So Ahab coveted that vineyard he had on his land. And so he wanted it. He coveted that. Naboth was, that was his inheritance. God had strict rules about those parcels of land where things were divided up so that one tribe, a larger tribe, wouldn't be able to use the kind of methods that Ahab was wanting to do to gain from others. And then, I mean, that, over time, what would happen to the little tribes? I mean, they would get eaten up. God had very strict laws for that. So Naboth couldn't do what Ahab wanted to do to give up that land. So Jezebel came up with a plan. What was it? To falsely accuse him of blaspheming God and the king. And so those men of Belial were set up to falsely accuse him, and then everybody took him out and stoned him. So he was condemned falsely and then killed when he was righteous, so that what he had could be taken by a rich man, who was the king. I mean, that's exactly what he's describing there in James 5 and verse 6. You condemned and killed the just. And that's the common word for kill. It's the same Greek word in when he translates the Old Testament commandment, thou shalt not kill. When we find that quoted in the New Testament, same word here. It's the common word for killing, but it literally means to murder. So they were condemning and murdering the just. Now, when he says the just, what does that mean? This is dikaios is the Greek word, and it means equitable. I mean, that's the literal definition. It's from the word that means right. It's the common word for righteous, for the righteous. So when it says somebody's a righteous person in the New Testament, which there are lots of examples of that, a righteous man, that's the word here. So they had condemned and killed the righteous. So they were coveting things and they were taking away, and we saw what they did to the laborers that had done no wrong when they had done the work, and then they wouldn't give them their wages. Well, now they're going even further to be willing to kill people that were innocent and righteous. And we know there were more. There was more than just that they were innocent of any wrongdoing in the particular circumstance, but these were genuinely righteous people that were victims of this. All right, well, what did he say back in when we were studying in chapter 2 when the two different men came into the assembly of the church? One of them was rich and the other was poor. And who did they get all excited over and show favor to? Yeah, the rich one. Like nobody would do that today, right? I mean, that's what people do naturally, which we have to learn otherwise and not be a respecter of persons, the outward man, including by what a person has or doesn't have of this world's possessions. And so one of the things that was pointed out to these brethren who had favored the rich one that came into their assembly over the poor, he asked in verse 5, where he said, "Hearken, my beloved brethren, hath not God chosen the poor of this world rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom which he hath promised to them that love him?" Verse 6, "But you have despised the poor. Do not rich men oppress you and draw you before the judgment seats? Do not they blaspheme that worthy name by the which you are called?" So he was reminding them of who was, when Christians were persecuted, ultimately who was behind it. Not a bunch of poor people, but rich ones. And they were the ones that had the means and the power to be able to have them haul before the judgment seats to condemn and to have them killed. And this is what they were doing to the righteous. So here's another reminder to these brethren, like he said in chapter 2, that the ones that was the cause of their persecutions for their faith were rich ones. And how did these righteous ones respond to being condemned and killed by these rich men? What does it say in verse 6? "And he does not resist you." That's interesting. Well, that's certainly a characteristic that would only be found among followers of Christ. What other group of people would not resist something like that when they were innocent and righteous and they were being condemned and killed? I mean, did they go down fighting? They didn't. They didn't resist the ones who had that power over them and were doing that evil to them. Well, who was that like? What did our master do? No, he didn't resist. He didn't speak against them. He didn't fall to any temptation to do that when it was God's will for that to happen. Now, there was a particular death that our Heavenly Father had in store for His Son for the reasons that He tells us, and all of that was foretold by the prophets back in the Old Testament. Were there any attempts made on Christ's life prior to His actual death? Yes, quite a few of them, but it was not... That wasn't the right time. That did not fulfill God's will and His plans for how His Son was going to die. And so before it was the right time, God's way, then what happened? Well, one of the notable examples, when he began preaching and he went to his hometown of Nazareth, and he read from the prophet Isaiah, how he was anointed to preach the gospel and to do the miracles that he was now doing with the power he had just recently been given from his Father by the Holy Spirit after he was baptized of John. And he said, this day, this scripture is fulfilled in your ears. They got mad, and they took him up to a brow of the hill where the city was built, and they were going to cast him off that. They were going to kill him there, the ones from his hometown. But what did he do? He passed through the midst of them. We read about times where he hid himself when it was not going to go the way God intended, and God got him out of that. So if we can hide, if we can run, if there's a way out of trouble that the Lord provides, does this say don't take that way? That's not what that's saying. But if we are taken and we're in that situation and there's no escape, no way to run, no way to hide, we can't get away, and then what's going to happen is going to happen. Well, what do we do then? What are we supposed to do? And I don't want to invite something on myself by saying, well, I wouldn't. We have to recognize what God's will is, and we have to aspire to fulfill that, to be like Christ and like he commands us to be. Let's turn to Matthew chapter 5. Verses 38 and 39, this can be what he's teaching here, can be some of the most difficult words that Christ taught for people to accept, to believe, difficult to put into practice. If one is convinced that these words are to be obeyed, which they are, but in Matthew 5, starting in verse 38, he says, you've heard that it has been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Well, that was the Old Testament law, and this is in the Sermon on the Mount, and this is at the end. This is the culmination of a long section of that sermon where Jesus was making a contrast between what they had heard that was in the law of Moses and now what he was teaching that is going to be and is now, of course, part of Christ's everlasting covenant, the new covenant. And so the old covenant did say an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Verse 39, Jesus said, but I say unto you that you resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. And how many people in this world have heard the phrase and know it, turn the other cheek? If they've never read it, I mean, how many people know that saying that have never read it for themselves in the Bible? A lot. I mean, it's known. I mean, this is the Lord has made it that way, that this teaching of Christ is something that is very well known. Even in this godless time that we, ungodly time that we live in. And so he said that you resist not evil, but whosoever will smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. And people start, well, does that mean, and people will start to get defensive and start arguing that. Jesus said what he said. I've heard people say, well, okay, that's in the one time, but if they hit that other one, then it's game on. I mean, that's not what he says. It's not like, well, you can do that once, and then if they keep doing this, then you can fight them tooth and nail. I've also heard, I've heard people argue, well, okay, that's, maybe if somebody does something small, I don't know, but getting hit in the face doesn't sound too small to me. But some said, well, okay, if it goes beyond that, if they're coming after your life, then different matter. But we actually see it brought to the ultimate point there in James 5:6, don't we, when somebody's being wrongly condemned and then killed when they're righteous. And he says he doesn't resist you. So those brethren, how far did they take this principle that Jesus taught? That's as far as you can take it, isn't it? When they're actually put to death. And they were in that situation. That would be a very difficult thing to do. And then there's much more that even comes after that. In verse 40, if any man will sue thee at the law and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. Now, who does that? Who does that? If somebody's trying to take away something from them, they're not going to do everything they can to hold on to what rightfully belongs to them. Where they're not only going to not resist somebody's effort to take away from them what they shouldn't, but then give them something else on top of it willingly. Brother Jan? You're just going to be a patsy, and everybody's going to walk all over you.
Proverbs 16:32, he says, he that is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he that rules the spirit, but he that takes a city. So, you know, people don't recognize that it takes a lot of spiritual strength and faith to carry out what Jesus is teaching and what James is teaching.
And Christ himself, how much strength did it take when all he had to do was say the word, and he could have had how many angels? More than 12 legions of angels, if he had asked his father. He had the power to do. I mean, who can call on that? And you can look at scriptures that we have, things that just a single angel could do. And what could more than 12 legions of angels do if Christ had called for them? I mean, He could have said the word, and all those people that were hitting him, spitting on him, blaspheming him, mocking him, and then scourging him and crucifying him. I mean, he could have, before it ever got to that, I mean, at whatever point, he could have called on he could have had all of those people wiped out instantly just by saying the word. Now, to have that power to be able to do that and then to take all that he took, was that weak or was that strong? I mean, that would take incredible strength to be able to do what he did. I mean, it was that's why he's our ultimate example to follow. But yes, that takes a vast amount of strength to have the control not to do what would be the natural thing to do. And that would be to go after anybody that's going after you. Verse 41, whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain. That's two. And that's they lived under the Roman, they were under Roman rule during this time. And the Romans had their soldiers could compel anyone. When they were carrying their burdens, they could compel anybody to carry their burdens for a mile. Well, if that happened, I mean, here you are minding your own business, and some Roman soldier says, hey, you, carry this a mile. You have to do it. But somebody who doesn't feel like carrying that go a whole mile carrying that Roman soldier's load. Well, what does a Christian do? And Jesus says, if they compel you to do that, go too. From that, we get what saying comes from that we use so often, go the extra mile. I mean, there's so many things from these teachings that people are so familiar with. But what about doing it? And it wouldn't be easy. It would not be easy at all. And verse verse 42, give to him that asks thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn not thou away. And then he continues it to, well, not just hear things, don't resist him. In fact, don't do this, but then do that. But then it's even, it goes further in verse 43 when he says, you've heard that it has been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. Well, did Jesus do that? I mean, the high priest had a lot of his servants that came there to apprehend Jesus in the garden that night when he was betrayed by Judas. So they knew exactly where he was going to be at that time. So they brought their people there where it wasn't going to be around the public, where they could end up facing a backlash. So they went and got him there. So here are all these ones that came to apprehend him, to arrest him, to take him so he could be put on trial and then put to death. That was the whole reason they were there, is to get him so that they were going to end up taking his life after a sham of some of a trial or a series of trials. So they were going to try to put some legal veneer on it, but the ultimate point was for them to kill him. And so they came to get him there, and we know that one of the servants of the high priest, and it was named Malchus, and when they came in and to take Jesus, Peter took his sword out and struck off his right ear. And so what did Jesus do at that point? And he told Pilate the next day, in one of his trials, he said, if my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight. Well, one of them started fighting, Peter did, but if Jesus had come to establish an earthly kingdom, that would have then come with earthly power, and he would have had his servants, he would have had an army to fight to establish that earthly kingdom, and they would have been fighting the Romans and everybody else. But that's not the kind of kingdom Jesus came to establish, and that's not the kind of power that it was going to be established by. And what did he tell Peter when Peter took that action? Told him to put his sword away, that the ones who lived by it would perish by it. Then what did he do? It's the last recorded miracle that he did on this earth. He healed that man's ear. A man that was there for what purpose? To come take his life. And then Jesus healed him. I mean, the last miracle that's recorded that he did was doing good to somebody who was doing him evil, the ultimate evil. Did he pray for them? What are the first words that were recorded when they put the nails in him and lifted him up on that cross? There's a record of 7 things that he said after he was crucified. The first of those 7 statements or words that he spoke was what? Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. He prayed for them. So when he's teaching, do good to the ones that are mistreating you and persecuting you, pray for them. I mean, he didn't just say that, he lived it. Well, how easy is it to do that? And this is an extension. It builds on what he was teaching starting in verse 38 there, for us to not resist evil and turn the other cheek and go the extra mile, all those things that are taught there. But to then love and do good to and pray for those ones that persecute you when they're doing you evil because you're doing the Lord's will. I mean, you can't be more innocent than that, can you? It's not even that you're just not doing something bad to them. You're doing God's will. You're serving Christ. You're doing what's good and right in the Lord's sight, and then you're being persecuted for that. What do you do? Well, you don't resist it, but then you do good to and love the ones that are doing that. I mean, these are not easy commandments that he's giving here. But how important is it? Verse 45, he says, do this that you may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. This is going to be an identifying characteristic of a Christian. Only a Christian would do this. And this is part of what will distinguish a Christian from someone who's not, somebody of this world. Now, anybody in this world wouldn't do that. He said that you may be the children of your Father which is in heaven, which says if we don't follow those commandments, then are we? We can't be. And so then he says, for he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust. Does God do good to his enemies? I mean, he's got a world with 7 billion people that are mostly in rebellion against him, sinning against him, doing evil to him, their maker, every day. He's still giving them their lives, sustaining them, feeding them, clothing them, all kinds of blessings that God is giving to everybody in this world every day. And then, of course, his son that he gave for all of them, all of us. So the ultimate example of doing good to your enemies is God himself, and that's what he's pointing out. This is what the Father, our Father, does. We're his children and identified as his children by doing as he does in this. Then he points out, for if you love them which love you, what reward have you? Do not even the publicans the same? And if you salute your brethren only, what do you more than others? Do not even the publicans so? Be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect. Complete is the word there. What's the subject? Love. God's love. Have a love that is not only for ones who love you, but includes even your enemies. That's a complete love there. Well, if we only love ones that love us, and we only do good to those who do good to us, how is that? How are we different than anybody else? He took the example of publicans. Those were Jews that were enlisted by the Romans to collect the tolls on roads and bridges and things of that nature, not the general taxation of their wages, but those kinds of things they would collect. And they could collect whatever sum they would owe the Romans, a certain amount, but then they could keep it. So they would, and they typically would extort and overcharge and get wealthy from doing that. So these were Jews that were extorting and taking from their own brethren, fellow Jews, on behalf of and in the service to the Romans that they were under. How were they regarded by their people? They were despised. I mean, that's why they're used as the example. I mean, Samaritans were the neighbors. They hated the Samaritans. But of their own kind, I mean, the publicans, I mean, they were absolutely hated by their fellow Jews. So he's saying, you're no different than one of them. I mean, they do good to the ones who do good to them, too. If that's all you do, you're no better than they are. No better than what they would view as the lowest of the low. Well, if the only people we resist and fight are ones that are doing evil to us, then how are we different than the world? So these aren't suggestions he's making there. These are important commandments to follow, not at all easy ones at all. And it takes some kind of strength to be able to do that. But this is a major way that we can show that we are following Christ by obeying those commandments when we're in that situation. And those ones he's talking about in James 5 and verse 6, they did that to the ultimate point, just like Christ did. Well, now he turns his attention. He really started turning the attention in verse 6. Verse 6 concludes what he was saying directly to those rich. But then verse 6 introduces us to what happens to the righteous. And he's talking about the righteous at the end of the verse. That continues now from that point to what follows thereafter and what he instructs in verse 7. So now he's no longer speaking directly. He's not speaking to those rich ones anymore. He's speaking to the brethren in verse 7 that should be these righteous ones that he mentioned in verse 6. And that's why he has the word therefore. Well, if being righteous means you're going to be persecuted and mistreated by a lot of rich people and whoever else, what kind of life are we going to have in service to Christ? Is it going to be an easy life, a trouble-free life? And people do try to, and they really are trying to be a salesman in that sense, but they're trying to sell Christianity as the way to have an easy life and where everything's going to go your way and all God's going to do is just pour out a bunch of blessings on you, especially material ones. So if you serve Christ, you'll be rich and have no troubles. Now, in actuality, if we go through the scriptures and search that, the characteristics of the ones who have few, if any, troubles and a lot of this world's good, are they the righteous or the wicked? I mean, that goes along with the ones who are wicked, that God is not working with. But when he's working with us, I mean, we're going to have a lot of troubles. I mean, we are. For being a Christian. So they're going to be, we're going to have to put up with rejection. We're going to have to put up with being mocked, ridiculed. And it may even be physical persecution. But as a follower of Christ, we have to recognize that's going to come. Hopefully not to the extreme of what he mentioned in verse 6. And we obviously would hope that none of us in this room ever have to face anything like that. But do we have any guarantees? No. I mean, it still happens in this world. It happens to people. We don't know what's going to happen down the line in our own country and what could come in the future. We hope it doesn't involve anything like that. But if it ever does, we need to prepare ourselves to do what's going to please the Lord in that situation. But we're still going to have persecution, like he says in 2 Timothy 3:12, yea, and all that will live godly in Christ Jesus shall suffer persecution. That's as comprehensive a promise as you can have. If our will is to live godly in Christ Jesus, we will suffer persecution. It's his will that we do. We have to be tested in that. So what does he say? Verse 7. And there's a therefore. So based on what he just said in verse 6 and what can happen to us, so it's really showing persecution to the ultimate extreme, but it's going to happen. Persecution will come, so what do we do? Therefore, he says, be patient, brethren. Be patient, therefore, brethren, unto the coming of the Lord. Behold, the husbandman waiteth for the precious fruit of the earth, and hath long patience for it until he receive the early and latter rain. Be also patient, establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord draweth nigh. So verses 7 and 8 go together, and in those two verses we see three times where he mentions that patience that we need to have. Now, is this the same as what we saw in the first chapter of the book? In chapter 1 and verse 3, when he says, knowing this, the trying of your faith worketh patience, but let patience have her perfect work, that you may be perfect and entire, wanting nothing. Not the same word. In chapter 1, it's the word patience means endurance. So we need endurance, and that's what we will grow in if we do endure the trials on our faith that he's speaking about there. So he's already talked about that in chapter 1, endurance. Now, this is a different word. This word here is macrothumio. Macro. When we hear, if something is macro to us, and that's a prefix in some of our English words, straight out of the Greek, what does it mean? Large, yeah. It's something big. If it's something little, it's micro. So we have micro and macro. Well, this is macrothumio, which is the root of that's thumos, which is the kind of anger that is a sinful degree. What we would most often identify or describe as a rage. But in this case, when put with the macro, this is the word for long suffering. So when he says be patient, he's telling us to be long suffering. So this is a different word. So do we need endurance? Yes. Do we need long suffering? Yes. Those are two closely related parts of the love, the nature of God. They're two things that go very closely together. They're closely related. And how are you going to have one without the other? How are you going to be able to endure persecutions for righteousness' sake, but not have long suffering in it? And forbearance, which means to put up with. Those are different words. They're not exactly the same, but they're related. And when we grow in one, we're going to be growing in the others. And that happens. There's a lot of these things. A lot of the parts of God's nature, His love, are really they kind of come in different groups. And if you're growing in one of those things, you're going to be growing in a lot of others. So it needs to, of course, to the widen out to where we're growing in all of it. But endurance and long suffering, those are two different words. This one is long suffering. So he says, be patient, therefore. Literally, that would be long suffering. And we have a lot of cases where that's the word when we see long suffering in the New Testament. That's the word that he's using, the one that's, I don't know why they translated patient here. To me, if there's consistency with the translation, if I would like it if every time I read patient or patience, it was a form of the word endurance. And if it was long suffering, then it would be translated long suffering every time. I wasn't around when King James commissioned this and approved with the translations. Not that it's awful. We can look it up. But anyway, just pointing out, that's what this word is. So here he's speaking about being long-suffering, which is also, twice in verse 7, and then the same in verse 8. So we see it three different times, the same word there. So he says we need to be long-suffering. And he says, unto. That word means until. So we need to be long-suffering until the coming of the Lord. If we lose that and our long-suffering ends before the coming of the Lord, what's going to happen to our endurance also? It's going to fall short then. If that comes to an end before it's supposed to, then what's going to happen? We're going to be falling to some temptation. Really, of the variety that we were just reading about that he was teaching us not to back in Matthew chapter 5, where we're going to be tempted to strike out against, to resist, to take action against ones that are doing these things to us. And so if we show long suffering through all of those persecutions, and then finally we reach our point that that's enough. No more turning the other cheek. No more going, I'm not going any more extra miles. I'm not doing any more of this. Now some eyes and tooths are going to start coming out on the other side. If we get to that point, then we're going to be falling to temptation and not fulfilling the Lord's will. So We need to be long-suffering all the way until the coming of the Lord. Well, what may happen before the Lord comes back? We might leave this world by death. We don't know how our time on the earth is going to end, whether it's going to be by death or when the Lord returns, but either way, we need to be long-suffering until the moment we leave this world, so that we don't fall to temptation before we are done. So that's the main point there of verse 6. Verse 7. There's more to go. I'm just going to have to stop here. I'm either stopping here or we're going to be going for probably another 10 or 15 minutes. So the clock is against me tonight. I can't resist it. Lord willing, we'll continue there in James 5 and verses 7 and 8, and look more at this long suffering that we need, what the Lord says, teaches about that, and the context of what we're to be long suffering in. So we got more to look at there, and we'll try to do that, Lord willing, next Wednesday night.